So we begin our journey now through the Old Testament, beginning with prophecy. What is prophecy? I've already introduced to you earlier the scrolls of the prophets, and I've given you a copy in paper, so you don't need to look at that again now. The Greek word, which is where we get the word prophecy from, prophetes, means, it doesn't mean one who foretells the future. And by the time I've finished today, I hope you've actually got rid of that idea almost altogether. It's one who, the Latin word, profemi is Greek, the Latin is proclamo. It means to proclaim, to speak before, not temporally before, but before the community, to dare to stand up and give words to what the prophet, accepted or unaccepted, has discerned to be something he's discerned in prayer that needs to be heard. From their communion with God, prophets proclaim to the people what they understood was God's will. And the prophet's task was to listen and proclaim, to see and to enlighten. I've given you a text then from Ezekiel chapter 3 verse 17 where this is mentioned. And Zahar, you don't have to know that, the Hebrew word, is nearly always translated warn. So I guess that's how you find it in your Bible translation. It's a problematic word. I think it's actually a wrong translation. The only time this is a verb, the noun actually means radiance. I think a better translation and a more accurate one is enlighten. So, Son of Man, says God to Ezekiel, I've made you a sentinel for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall enlighten them from me. Shed light on the reality of their situation. It may imply a warning, may include a warning, but more generally it is to enlighten. The prophets saw themselves as part of a long prophetic tradition, lost in the mist of history. There are two main prophets mentioned in the Torah called prophets. One is Abram, Genesis chapter 20, verse 7, and again in Genesis 18. And we're told of this Abraham that he stood before Yahweh. That's key to what they mean by prophet. Stood before Yahweh, and then, of course, spoke. Hosea speaks of Moses as a prophet in chapter 12. And in the community, there was an accepted trust that Yahweh would continue to raise up a prophet like Moses. They held on to that. Raise up a prophet like Moses. Jump to the New Testament. The prophet like Moses, of course, was his successor, Joshua. But in the New Testament, looking back, they saw Jesus as the fulfillment of this promise. Text from Jethro, the father-in-law, speaking to Moses, Exodus chapter 18. He said, you should represent the people before God. You should bring their cases before God. Teach them the statutes and the instructions and make known to them the way they are to go, the Torah, and the things they are to do. That's your job, says Jethro to young Moses. And he goes on to tell Moses he's trying to do too much on his own and he should get some helpers. And Moses does. He gets 70 of them to help him. And you look after the important matters, he says to Moses, but let the rest go. You're busy from day to night and you're not actually doing what you should do. Perhaps father-in-laws are allowed to speak like that. Then there are three main prophets in the scrolls called the former prophets, books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings. You know them? Samuel, is very key to it. He's the last of the judges, inverted commas, and the first of the prophets in history. The others are prehistory, the mists of time. History is Samuel, and then you know about Elijah and Elisha. Prophecy was not something that only happened in Israel. I'm going to read to you from some of the Middle Eastern, Far Eastern texts, and I'll read the actual text, but as I read Baal Shamayin, you think Yahweh, and you could swear this comes straight out of one of the prophetic books. I lifted up my hands to Baal Shamayin, the Lord of the heavens. And Baal Shamayin answered me, and Baal Shamayin spoke to me through seers and messengers. And Baal Shamayin said to me, fear not, because it was I who made you. I made you king, and I shall stand with you, and I shall deliver you from all the kings you have forced a siege upon you. That's got nothing to do with the Bible, but you can swear it came straight out of it. It's a similar pattern of strange, important, charismatic, mystical, who knows, characters in the history of all these people who claim to speak for God and perhaps do. Here's another one. I, Ishtar, will go before you and behind you. Fear not. You've heard that before. I, the Lord, I, Yahweh. I won't do too much of this, but fear not, Ashurbanipal, the kings of the Assyrians. Now, as I have spoken, it will come to pass. I shall grant it to you. Over the people of the four languages and over the armament of the princes, you will exercise sovereignty. You could put Yahweh and David in there, and you could think, where's that? Is that in the book of Kings? Where's it from? No, it's from an ancient Eastern text of related people. Last one. The kings of the countries confer together. Come, let us rise against Ashurbanipal. And Ninlil, one of the eastern gods, answered, the kings of the lands I shall overthrow, place under your yoke, their feet in strong fetters. Fear not, as she that bears for her child, so I care for you. I've placed you like an amulet on my breast. Fear not, my son, whom I have raised. Point is clear. We're dealing with a kind of phenomenon that was throughout all the nations, including Israel. Future predictions and divine-human interaction. Now look at this, because I want to get rid of it. Prophecy has almost nothing to do with foretelling the future. You're not helped by the Oxford Dictionary, of course, which that defines, because that's the way we've used the word prophecy for so long. In fact, in an earlier form of argument, they used to prove that Jesus was divine by the prophecies which he fulfilled and by his miracles. Neither prove it, by the way. It's a very poor argument. And we've got to ditch them because they're almost dishonest. Prophecy has something but little to do with foretelling the future. You're going to find, to sum up what I want to share with you, when it's about what will happen to you, and you will find that in some of the prophets, to the you meaning the contemporaries of the prophet, it might go for one generation or two, that's it. It's saying if you don't do this, your children are going to suffer, your grandkids are going to suffer, the enemy will come in, and like you could do that too. People who are pretty sensible and with it can see the consequences, immediate consequences, of behaviour. And so they talk about it and say it. When they talk about God, just read any of the prophets, you'll find this. When they talk about God, it's always in poetry, it's always vague, it's always non-specific, And the point they're making is, whatever we do, whatever we muck up, even if you don't listen, even the prophets are saying, God will be in your future and God will love you, choose you, correct you. God, it's about the lion will lie down with the lamb. You know that, like it's poetic statements about God is bigger than us, and so God will always be there. At first glance, the argument looks simple. God knows everything. God can know, see the future. Well, God can reveal the future to his prophets. That looks logical, looks simple. God gives them a crystal ball and tells them something that's going to happen in the future. It doesn't happen like that, by the way, but that's the way we used to argue, and that's the way it can look. A prophet is a seer. He sees the divine purpose, not completely, but and often wrong, but often right. He sees beyond what we see to the implications of behavior, and he sees what God is wanting to do in Israel. But he also sees what's happening around him, the human action. And either the people are going to be obedient to the word of God spoken through Isaiah or Jeremiah or whoever. Either they're going to obey, which will have consequences for them, or they're going to disobey, and that'll have consequences for them too. The future predictions that you actually find, I can't go this into detail now, but I will do a little bit later. Some of them are based on intelligent observation, which you'd expect, build-up of the military. Isaiah, a diplomat in the court of the southern, the court of Jerusalem, he can see what's happening in Assyria. The Syrians have been conquered, that's Aram, Syria, present Syria. Assyria is Iraq. And Iraq, or Assyria, we're next, he's saying to them. If we don't do something about it, if we don't obey God, etc. They can see it coming. A lot of people probably could. Alliances, social unrest, and they draw consequences, as you might. But you're not looking at a crystal ball. You're just an intelligent person seeing what's highly likely to happen. Predictions are often written back in the text. We have, especially in the Torah, we have the patriarchs foreseeing what will happen to Judah, what will happen to then Isaac and Esau, and as they write. But what you're reading when you read those literature, you're reading a play. You're reading literature written after the event. And so in order to make the point that what's happening to us has roots right back in history, in the created form, and that's what it is, it's a story, it's a beautiful story like you would find in the Greek world or any world for that matter. And so you see Abraham will foresee something as staged. It's a staged thing, and they want to see that what happened now was goes right back into the roots of history, and so they do it. There's some examples. We're told in 1 Kings 13 that Josiah, who lives in the 600s, 7th century BC, is going to reconquer the north. And that's said by someone centuries before Josiah. We didn't even know Josiah was... It's not a prophecy. It's not going back and getting evidence that someone foresaw all this. It's saying this is what happened, and that's put back into their stories, into their mystery, not history. In Genesis, Noah foresees the relationship between Shem and Canaan. Shem, the Semites, and the Canaanites. Yahweh's promise to Abraham, I will make you a father of many nations, etc. Jacob foretells the destiny of all his sons as he's about to die. You have to learn that you're watching a concocted story, a lovely story, that is written for the contemporaries of the authors that are writing it, so that they will link themselves, every culture does this, usually in just words, stories. I'm a Fallon, and my father told me I'm descended from the kings of Ireland. I felt good about that. I since found out that there was everyone on a hill was a king. So it didn't kind of prove a lot. But that's how history's handed on. You're probably all very famous people. You needn't tell me now. So, yeah. Read the Greek stuff in Homer. All the founders of the great cities and the Battle of Troy, and it's wonderful stuff. It's Shakespearean stuff. History, as we know it, I'll spend a whole lecture on this later. History, as we know it, is not in the Bible. There are unfulfilled predictions in the actual prophets. When you get out of the Torah and get to the prophets who lived in history, and you find the triumph of the Davidic dynasty, a reunited Israel and Judah. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 12 to 14. Well, if you like, you can see the founding of modern Israel at last. What he saw way back there has been fulfilled. If you want to go down that track, do so, but it's a bit stupid for my say-so. What they're seeing is they're looking back, and the New Testament's full of this. Matthew does it especially. He sees things happening in the life of Jesus. And he also sees that his sister never became a Christian, and his mum and dad didn't, and his nephew didn't. And he's trying to appeal to them, look, have another look at your religious heritage. And you'll see that Jesus is the fulfillment of it. Not that Isaiah foresaw Jesus, and he is Jesus, so that proves Isaiah is a prophet who can foresee the future. That's not it. It's looking back and saying, go back. Go back and read Isaiah chapter 2. Read Isaiah chapter 12. And you'll find, if you reread it, forget what the high priest said about Jesus being a heretic and getting him crucified. Reread it and get in touch with the spirituality of Isaiah or Jeremiah or whoever. And you'll find that Jesus is the flowering of it. Have another look at it. Reminds me of a time when I was in Haggita, actually, now that I think of it. And I was with my brother. I was sick at that time, and I went up there to try and see if I either die or live. My brother was there, and I stayed with him. And one morning, I just came out of this little hutty thing, and here was a cactus, which I don't find the most attractive of things. Maybe they are, but didn't look too attractive to me. But this morning, there was an absolutely stunning white lily. I'm calling it a lily, I don't know what to call it, flower. Beautiful thing that came. It was a full moon that night, by the way. And Jim said, oh, I'm glad you saw it. He said, because it won't be there tomorrow. It comes out every 4 years at the full moon of some season. But that's not a bad image for me, anyhow, of how Jesus fulfills the prophecies. The prophecies are a bit like cactus. And the ones who knew the prophecies really well crucified Jesus. So they didn't see it as a foretelling. But those who've got to know Jesus, if they'd only stop and look and go back, he fulfills, like the flower is fulfilling the energy and the life force of this cactus plant so that it'll be renewed. Well, Jesus is the fulfillment. Not looking forward, but looking back in faith. Ezekiel declared in chapter 26 that Nebuchadnezzar would destroy Tyre, and Nebuchadnezzar didn't restore it. So you can't have it both ways. He was wrong. He could see it happening, he thought. It didn't actually happen, though. He was just being as intelligent as he could, and he miscued. Ezekiel went on to declare that Yahweh would give Nebuchadnezzar Egypt instead. But this didn't happen either. Elisha predicted that Israel and Judah would capture the king of Moab. In fact, however, he sacrificed his eldest son to the god of Moab and defeated Israel's army. So, if you're going to read the literature honestly, there's bits and pieces in the prophetic literature that claim to be seeing consequences of people's behaviour, and they got it wrong. Well, we've got to bring that into our understanding of what prophecy is. Perhaps the key insight needed to understand prophetic predictions is to recognize that when Old Testament prophecy is concerned with future events on the human plane, It's presented and understood always with an implied condition. If you don't, this is going to happen. Or if. If people ignore the truth, they'll have to suffer the consequences. If they listen to God's word, they'll enjoy the consequent blessings. The prophet's inspired vision penetrates beyond the horizontal plane of historical events. The prophet is primarily concerned with the overarching providence of God, which transcends the plane of human decision and indecision, but is always present, gracing us. That's what the prophets are primarily saying. God's purpose transcends this, as does God's promise for the future. Whether or not we're going to enjoy God's blessing depends on whether or not we choose to respond to grace. But independent of our response, God's providence covers our future. It's God's grace which now and in the future inspires both our actions and our will to do them. There are some prophecies of warning called curses, which they're primarily faith statements. They remind the listener of who God is. They remind the listener of the fact that God's judgments are just. And they talk about God's anger. And they understood God was angry in our sense. Jesus wasn't in on about that, and we shouldn't be. But of course they thought that. Their kings and their rulers, when they did things out of anger, well, look out for yourself, because they had power. Well, God's the almighty power. And if you think, as we looked at yet last night, that everything that happens in the world is organized by God as a blessing or a punishment, then when something happens, well, God must be angry if it's hurting us. Jerusalem must have been destroyed because we did something wrong. That's Jeremiah and everybody else. So when they went into exile, they thought, what did we do wrong? Because we lost the war. You and I would look at it and say, we lost the war because we didn't have the ammunition that the Babylonians had. I mean, they just overwhelmed Jerusalem. It's a pretty simple statement. No, they had to think, well, but God wouldn't have allowed it unless we were... And this way he wanted to punish us for something. So their logical mind was skewed because they thought God's all-powerful means God can do anything God wants and everything comes from God's control. That's what all the prophets thought, every single one of them. Jesus didn't. Who sinned, they said, this man or his father? Jesus said, no, it's not about their sin. And then he takes the man and born blind and heals him. God's anger. God must be angry because Jerusalem's fallen, broken. We've lost the war. We've lost the Ark of the Covenant. The Philistines have got it. Why would God allow that? God couldn't do anything about it because God doesn't control the world. He loves the world. And he's not jumping in, sorting it out all the time. Dreadful things happen because we do dreadful things. Beautiful things happen because we listen to grace and behave beautifully. On the human historical plane, these warnings or curses, if you do this, etc., etc., they function as warnings to bring about a change of mind and heart, lest evil bear its rotten fruit. Then there are prophecies of blessing. And the assumption all the time, the apostles had it, was that if you're living a healthy life and you've got plenty to eat and you've got a lovely home, and then God must be blessing you, so you must be doing something really beautiful in your life. You must be very good. Jesus comes along and tells the rich young man to get rid of all his possessions because they're getting in the road. And he thinks, what do you mean? They're all God's blessings. And the apostles take Jesus aside and say, What are you talking about? They're kind of confused by him because suddenly all this wealth and prosperity and health apparently have nothing to do with God's blessing. They've got something to do with your genes and with chance and perhaps with violence and injustice, and everything's up for questioning now. So the prophecies of blessing were primarily faith statements. They reminded people of God's transcendent, loving providence, which is true, of course. In addition, they were hope statements, encouraging fidelity and obedience so as to establish the conditions in which God's will could be realized and God's blessing enjoyed. Now we come to the essence of prophecy. It's not about foretelling the future. It's about a critique of the present. Prophets are talking to real people in a real situation. All you've got to do is read them to see this. Prophecies, chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter, and there's nothing to do with the future at all. It's all about us, our behaviour, the consequences that it could have, etc. But it's about now. Far more significant in Old Testament prophecy than prediction of the future is the critique which the prophets make of their contemporary society, and they make the critique in God's name. Not always right, but often enough right for their prophecies to be preserved, lest we forget. Personal encounter with Yahweh sharpened their awareness of the contrast between social behavior and the authentic Yahwist religious insights. Their task was to, quote from Amos, declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. Name what's happening in the society that is against Yahwism, against their whole religious movement. Name it. And they got killed for it, by the way. Insisting that sin must be punished, but also insisting that there was something that transcended punishment, namely Yahweh's fidelity to who Yahweh is. Yahweh's promises will be kept. They keep telling us that. Fear not. Diane Bergen, an American scripture scholar, puts it so carefully and simply that I'll quote her. The prophetic word was always relevant in the historical moment of proclamation. Of course. What on earth would Isaiah be talking to his contemporaries about when he was thinking of Jesus and Mary and the conception of, for God's sake, they wouldn't know what he wouldn't know what he was talking about, and they wouldn't know what he was talking about. He's talking to real people, and they got it or didn't get it, but they were. So it's the historical moment that the proclamation, since it was born out of religious or political crisis, the purpose of prophecy of the prophetic word was to speak to that crisis. It clung to the past to the extent that it was in continuity with the fundamental religious traditions of their people. So they keep making links back with the past. It's not just a new idea they're coming up with. They're trying to wake people up to who they really are. It predicted the future to the extent that that future would be the consequence of the present. What we need to do now will have consequences for the future. The primary intent of prophecy was to call the people to fidelity to their religious responsibilities here and now. It's for this reason that it is important to read the prophetic literature in the light of the specific historical circumstances to which the words were addressed or in which the writings were recorded. In a few days' time, I'll actually be taking you from the beginning of the Bible, historically, right through, and we'll look at some of these prophets in their historical setting. For the moment, I'm just talking about prophecy in general. The power of the prophetic utterance comes precisely from its specific nature. Once this is grasped, it's up to us, following the example of the disciples of the prophets, to apply what they say, you're reading Isaiah, Jeremiah, whatever, and in the Mass, they're often given to us, to apply what they say to our changed circumstances. Isaiah wasn't writing for us, but maybe if we see who he was writing for and what the intent was of his words, we might think, well, has that got anything to say to our situation? Maybe we need to learn this lesson now too. not by a literal application of their words, but by a faithful following of their inspired insights. Now, I'll just do this quickly. There was a wide range of prophetic experiences then as now. They got all these words for these enigmatic, courageous, strange people that we know, list as prophets. They're called a Navi, a prophet, a Roe, a seer. They're called a Hose, one who enlightens. They're called the Ish Elohim, a man of God. They're some of the titles you find dotted right through the Bible. They make intelligent observations of the signs of their time. They critique charlatan practices. They're against, I'll read you from Deuteronomy, though these nations whom you are to dispossess listen to their soothsayers and their fortune tellers. And those people look into crystal balls and go, ooh, and then tell you what's going to happen in the future and read the palm of your hand and whatever. They're soothsayers. The Lord your God won't permit you to do that. He doesn't want them to be getting caught up in charlatan behavior, because we want to know the future will be good for us. Dreams, visions, ecstasy, trance, as well as perceptive and critical judgments, both of the times and of the will of Yahweh, and many other factors were at play in the prophetic experience and in the way this experience was conveyed. Some critiques from the prophets. This is Ezekiel chapter 2. Listen to the words I say. I is God. Prophet feels he's speaking for God. Open your mouth and eat what I'm about to give you. This is instructions for Ezekiel. Then go and speak. So eat the word, digest the word, live with the word, and then speak from it, says God to Ezekiel. Jeremiah, you have seduced me, Yahweh. And I let myself be seduced. You've overpowered me. You were the stronger. I'm a laughingstock. Everybody's butt. Jeremiah is telling the people Jerusalem's going to be destroyed and the temple's going to be destroyed. Every single other prophet, I'll come back to that in a minute, will say, no, 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 this is God's temple. It'll be all right. And he's a lone voice. And of course they didn't like him. But he can't stop. He says, the word of Yahweh has meant for me insult, derision all day long. I used to say, I won't think about him. I won't speak his name anymore. Switch on the TV and watch some Deadwood Dick thing and get it out of your head. Stop all this praying. However, the poor bloke couldn't do it. There seemed to be a fire burning in my heart, imprisoned in my bones. And the effort to restrain it wearied me, and I couldn't bear it, so up he got and talked again. Jeremiah's very lovely, really. He's so emotional. We can all kind of feel our relationship with an ordinary, yeah. How do you discern true from false prophecy? That's a question they never got an answer to. You can't get one now, either. It's very subtle, it's very profound, it's very deep, and we're not all that good at it. To be accepted as authentic prophecy, these were some of the criteria, our oracles had to be uttered in the name of Yahweh. Find that in Deuteronomy 13. And they must be consistent with the inspired words and deeds of Moses. So that's one. So if someone said something that was clearly contradictory to Moses, then he can't be a good prophet. That's pretty straightforward. Consistency with approved prophecy, Jeremiah chapter 23, puts that forward. Sensible. And when prophecies included future predictions, the authenticity of the prophecy could only be guaranteed after the event. It couldn't work out, obviously, till it happened, and there's plenty of texts on that. Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 3, prophet no less than priest all practice fraud, says Jeremiah. So the fact that someone calls himself a prophet doesn't make him one. Clearly, they're fraudulent. They look, what a lovely image. They dress my people's wound, these other false prophets, without concern. Peace, peace, they say, but there's no peace, says Jeremiah. They're just appealing to the get voted in the next parliament or whatever. Jeremiah again, don't listen to what the prophets say. This is all pretty modern, we still have to do this. They're deluding you. They retail visions of their own, not what comes from the mouth of Yahweh. You can see that anyone who preaches a homily, I think poor Michelle's going to preach today, but any of you ever preached a homily, this is big stuff, isn't it? Am I just giving my own soapbox favourite thing? Or am I listening and listening and listening and perhaps still getting it wrong, but at least wanting to speak for something bigger than me? Well, we know what we should be doing. I haven't sent them, says, this is God speaking through Jeremiah. I haven't sent them, but they're running. I haven't spoken to them, but they're prophesying. Let the prophet who has a dream tell the dream as his own. This is all in Jeremiah. And let him who receives a word from me deliver it accurately. Doesn't my word burn like a fire? Isn't it like a hammer shattering the rock? I never sent them, says God, Jeremiah again, or commissioned them, and they serve no good purpose for his people. So false prophecy is obviously rampant at the time, and it always will be. Ezekiel. Say to those who make up prophecies out of their own heads, the Lord Yahweh says, woe to the foolish prophets who follow their own spirit without seeing anything. Let, like jackals in a ruin, so are your prophets, Israel. They've never ventured into the breach. They've never bothered to fortify the house of Israel or stand fast in battle. They've empty visions and give lying prophecies and say it's Yahweh who speaks, although Yahweh hasn't sent them. Instead of my people rebuilding the wall, they slap on plaster. So you can't see the cracks. Gee, we all need to listen to that, don't we? And now the most important thing I want to share with you. Because I found it quite new for me, going back a few years now, but to realise, I took it, the Bible is the Bible and it's written there and that's it. No. This is how a prophetic scroll develops and keeps developing. And keeps developing. Sadly, there came a time when we put it in a book and clipped the cover, and there it is. So we now just keep repeating it. The danger is it mightn't develop the living word. So I'll take you through it. Some of the prophets committed their oracles to writing. We know that. Here's one from Isaiah. Yahweh said to me, take a large tablet and write on it, and have it attested for me by reliable witnesses. We're now in history. We're in the 8th century BC, and writing is happening in Israel for the first time. So here's the prophet or his secretary or whoever had the skill, was writing down this stuff, because that makes it something you can remember and hand on. Here's Isaiah again. Write it before them on a tablet, inscribe it in a book, so that it may be for all time to come a witness forever. It gives it a solidity. The words, this is Jeremiah, the words of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the remaining elders among the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. And here we have a letter, we've still got the copy of it, in the book of Jeremiah, sent by Jeremiah, the next century after Isaiah, to the exiles in Babylon. And there it is. It's great to have it. Yahweh answered, this is Habakkuk. Yahweh answered me and said, write the vision. Make it plain on tablets so that the runner may read it. Now, since they believed that it was God himself who was communicating with his people through the events of their history, the authors readily prefaced their inspired insights with expressions such as, Yahweh said. Well, they were all doing this, even the false prophets. So, God says we must, coming from any pulpit in the place, maybe right, maybe wrong, depends where it's coming from. But this is their way of saying that at least they think what they're saying comes from Yahweh. It may or may not, that'll have to be tested. The Old Testament is the fruit of centuries of reflection by people who were convinced that their God, Yahweh, the Lord of creation and the Lord of history, had chosen them in love and had a special mission for them in the world. And so you see the prophetic tradition developing. They believed that there was a special providence guiding their history. They kept reflecting on it to remember God's love and covenant with them, and to discern God's will, as well as to learn from their mistakes and so become more sensitive, attentive, and faithful. Just as you read the book of Jeremiah, which has an assurance attached to it because of its use and preservation and copying and means of people who've read it and prayed through it. It's beautiful stuff. You don't know about the other ones because they dropped out of history or just were never written down or got lost. But we've got Jeremiah and Isaiah, etc. So we look at them and we try and learn from them and hand on what we've learned to others. Much of what we have, however, in when we open the scroll of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, is the work of disciples. It wasn't that when Jeremiah died, the scroll was complete and that's it, and that's what you're reading. No, no, no. People kept reading it. And when new circumstances arose, they thought, ah, that's really what Jeremiah was getting at. So they put that into the text. They update it. Being updated all the time. Much of what we have is the work of disciples, court officials, cult officials, who committed to writing the oracles of the prophets. Later generations, attempting to understand themselves in the light of these prophecies, they saw the prophetic oracles in a new light. They thought, ah. They understood particular historical events as realizations of the transcendent hope or the warnings of this prophet. They expected that God's will would be beyond their ability to comprehend fully, so they approached the inspired word, later rabbis, fall of Jerusalem, Christianity, the destruction of the city. They're rethinking all this stuff and reimagining and rewriting it, looking for the insights that are there. So it's a living word, kept alive. The text expressed inspired insights into the presence and action of a living God in their history. No text could hold it all. And so the history of the development of the Old Testament is a history of prayerful debate, coming back, returning from the exile, the elders of the city, the priests that came back, different groups sitting down, Jews love doing this, sitting around a table arguing and saying, no, 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 yeah. And then eventually they ended up with what we call the Bible, coming out of all that living discussion and faith-filled stuff. No text could hold it all. The history of the development of the Old Testament is a history of prayerful debate, discussion, refinement, always in the light of historical experience. Inspiration cannot be understood if we think of it as applying only to those who produced the final text. All along the line, people were attentive to the movement of God's Spirit in their hearts, in the way they lived and in the way they gave expression to their experiences. It's a constant providential inspiration, guiding, imperfectly picked up and all was in the light of experience, reimagining and reliving and restating the essential insights as seen of their ancient prophets. Generations of scholars were responsible for the evolving sources that the final authors drew on. And there were those who cherished these ancient scrolls and copied them and made sure they were handed on. Inspiration has to cover the whole process of reflecting, listening, discussion, prayer, copying. Joseph Blenkinsop, a marvellous scholar, and he writes in English, but he actually writes English. Really, one of those rare scholars who actually writes in a way you can read, and accessible and interesting. So if you ever see him, read the book. In his book called A History of Prophecy in Israel, Joseph Blenkinsop states that the prophetic books of the Old Testament reveal, and I'm quoting, a cumulative process of appropriation, assimilation, and adaptation that shades off into an increasingly frequent recycling and reinterpreting of older prophetic material. It's a very important insight to get. As the Second Vatican Council states, we can be confident, and this is a very tricky text, and if, as I present it to you now, you're going to find it's almost unintelligible, but it's the best they could do. The Second Vatican Council states, we can be confident that these texts express without error, we like that, without error, the truth which God willed to be put down in the sacred writings for the sake of our salvation. It's got to be a true statement, but it's a bit of a circular argument. How do you work out what God willed and what the prophet said wrongly? How do you sort it all out? Well, we've got to have Jesus to help us, because we were in the habit of saying the Bible, it's all true. There are people who shout that from the hilltops too. I think I've done enough with you in the last day to indicate I don't know what you mean by that. I kind of know what it could mean, but it has to be very carefully discerned. And that's one way of kind of compromising and making a statement, which they tried to do, that yes, it's all true. Well, at least those bits that God wanted to put in are true. So we're still going to find out what God wanted. Before all else, the Bible is a truthful statement of God's faithful love. That's true. Expressed, of course, in the limited, imperfect, and historically conditioned way in which human authors necessarily speak and write of such matters. The community considers these texts foundational and continues to experience God's inspiration through them. The pity was, I think it's a pity, that we tended, or the Jewish community, with Christianity bleeding Judaism, and then with Vespasian and Titus, the Roman emperors, destroying their city, Judaism looked as though it wasn't going to survive. So, in a case, the rabbis got together under Gamaliel, it's the second, and they made a bit of a decision about what books they would hold, and they kind of fixed it. And they had to be ancient, and they had to be Hebrew, and I won't go into all that with you. But that's why we've got now this canon of the ancient scriptures. The Christians still allowing, as inspired, the Jewish books that were written in Greek or translated into Greek and lost in Hebrew because they were too modern. So you've got all this going on, but we finally ended up with a book. Dangerous thing to have, beautiful thing to have, only if we learn to not take the covers completely seriously, but to allow the need for development. And that's what theology is, by the way. The New Testament turned the Bible, got to the heart of the Bible, and we still have, thank God, we've got Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and Catherine of Siena and all these mystics and poets and prophets and And a living tradition is still being handed on to us. Those who claim that the sacred scriptures are inspired, and I'm claiming that, are not claiming that they're free from error in areas that are not central to the witness they give of God's action in the history of Israel and how the people ought to respond. It's essential also to recognize that even in this, their central thrust, they're human documents. And as we'll hope to show, they're not free from mistaken assumptions that were part of their time and their culture. And I dealt with some last evening. However, with all these necessary limitations, they continue to inspire with care. For in their precise beauty, they do reveal God. I could do this, I won't, it's in the book if you want to read it. Many texts that are about violence and God commanding violence. Well, they got it wrong, thanks to Jesus. But there's example after example. Believe me, and look up the book, and you've got all those texts there. And here's Jesus saying, it's not the will of your Father that one of the least ones should be lost. In his closing address to the meeting with the Eastern Patriarchs and Western Bishops following the Gulf War, Pope John Paul II declared, summing up what we've got to say and shout from the hilltops, there can be no such thing as a holy war. The Quran is full of it. Just about every chapter, surah, in the Quran is about hell. And hell is not believing what Muhammad is saying, because he's the prophet. And it's about jihad. And there are certain texts that do talk about inner jihad, you know, but nearly all of them are getting rid of, well, basically the Arab polytheists that are all around. And then, of course, Christianity too, because we believe in the Trinity. We don't believe in just one God, he thought. He misunderstood us. I can't find it hard to blame him because some of our words sound like we've got three gods. But he was that was his problem with Christianity. And he picked up all this stuff from the Jewish stuff that was on that page before that I went through quickly. About war. About God wanting violence to clear away all the ones that God hates. Well, the Pope tells us there can be no such thing as a holy war. To declare a holy war is to reduce God to our human level of jealousy, quarrels, and criminal hatred. Well, if you actually believe what John Paul II said, can you see that when you read prophets, you're going to have to do a lot of whiting out? Because they thought this was okay. In fact, wanted. Prophecy declined. The prophets that we've got are, and I'll do this with you later, they're gathered around certain points of history, very significant points of history. The collapse of the Northern Kingdom. There's four prophets living at that time because it was a terrible time. They didn't want that to happen again. So they remembered what was written and said about it at that time. Next one is when sent into exile. So there are prophets there. Jeremiah, the most main one, Ezekiel, others, Habakkuk, around that period. And there's another group who are around the return. It was such a shock to come back to it. And so you get a prophetic. But there were prophets all the way through. We just haven't got them. They weren't kept. It wasn't seen as particularly significant. The ones we've got belong to those significant moments of history that we had to keep reflecting on because we must have done something wrong for those dreadful things to happen and we don't want to do it again. Theology is bung, the logic isn't very good, But you can see why they were doing it. Perhaps the main reason for the decline in prophecy in the ancient Jewish world, in the Bible, was the fact that Judah was now living, after the return from exile, under the control of a foreign power, Persia and then Greece. When the king was an Israelite, a worshipper of Yahweh, then the prophets could say to the king, you can't do that. Look, this is what we really stand for. Of course they can do that. What's the point of saying that to the king of Persia? He's got nothing to do with the Bible and Yahweh and all that. They've got no... So that's one major reason why prophecy it stopped with the death of the kings, the end of the kings, pretty well. The prophets addressed themselves mainly to the rulers who were responsible for bringing about the reign of Yahweh in the Holy Land, so they could speak in-house stuff. When the government came from outside, there was no one to appeal to, and focus then moved away from prophecy to the cult, to the priesthood. And when they returned from exile, the priest, the high priest, was the central figure, because there's no king. When in the New Testament we talk about Jesus fulfilling the prophecies, I think I've said enough on that. What's happening is Matthew, John, they all do it, but particularly those two, they're pleading with their contemporaries to go and have another look at their spirituality and of their ancient prophets. And if they look at it again, they'll come to change their mind about Jesus. They'll see him as a lit flower coming out of a cactus, the beautiful fulfillment of all that Isaiah ever wanted. Isaiah didn't foresee Jesus, but Matthew and his contemporaries could see Jesus as the fulfillment of the spirituality of these ancient, spiritual, inspired men. I won't do what I've got here to do that because time is unfair, but you find Jesus throughout. I'll just go through them page after page, just give you an impression. Jesus in the Bible, in the Gospels, often refers back to these prophets. He was familiar with them, clearly, from the synagogue, of course, and he often quotes them. Now, you've got to be a little bit careful, because what you've got in the Gospel is not a tape recording of what Jesus actually said. You've got the writings of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. So you've certainly got statements that either, and maybe yes, were remembered that Jesus actually spoke, because he would have spoken so beautifully, and they would have remembered what he said. Memory was big in their day, and they didn't have filing cabinets, but they had good memories, because the only way they could learn. So yes, they could well have remembered at Nazareth, this is what Jesus did and this is what he said, of course. But often enough, if they can't remember it, we've certainly got an amazingly wonderful writer of the Gospel presenting the Jesus he knew and quoting these words, which were typical of the Jesus as he heard him, as he remembered him. So we know what he did with Jesus. We can't always be sure we've got verbatim the actual remembered words. But we've got, yeah. So here's Jesus talking about Elijah, the scene I began with in the picture of the transfiguration. Jesus is there with Elijah. Moses over there on your left, and Elijah, that's the story. That's a beautiful painting. It was the last painting done by Raphael, and it's stunningly beautiful, I can assure you. If you ever go to Rome, go to the Pinacoteca, the art gallery in the Vatican Museum, and that doesn't give it to you, but it's just wonderful. And then you've got the three apostles at the bottom here, and over on the far left, your far left, is the man who paid for the painting. It's fair enough that he gets in there. So, you know that scene. But please remember the end of it. Oh, Peter says, well, we want to stay here. We want you and Elijah and Moses, and we'll build three tabernacles, and we'll be here forever on the top of the mountain. This is marvelous stuff. And then God's word, this is my son, listen to him. And then it says, they looked up, but they saw only Jesus. We're being told by the gospel writers, I'm quoting Luke there, that no, the prophets, Moses and the prophets are all fulfilled in Jesus. We've got everything with him. Yes, let us read them and study them to enrich our understanding of Jesus, but by all means, but let's listen to them by watching Jesus. He'll make sense of them for us. Lepers, Naaman, Jesus quotes from these prophets, go and learn the meaning of the text. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I've come to call the righteous, not sinners, not the righteous, but sinners, says Jesus, quoting straight out of Hosea. Now, Jesus could well have said that, of course, because he knew the stuff really well. And there it is. He's taking them to their own text and reshaping them. Isaiah has this to say, go and say to the people, this is spoken to Isaiah, this is how Isaiah experienced God, keep listening but don't comprehend. They're not comprehending, but Jesus is saying to Isaiah, don't you stop talking. I want them to hear. They're not comprehending, but go for it. Do it. You need to do it. Keep listening, okay, you people, even though you're not comprehending. Keep looking hard, but not understanding. Make the mind of this people dull. Stop their ears, says Isaiah. Shut their eyes, so they won't see with their eyes, and listen with their ears, and comprehend with their minds, and turn to me to be healed. There's Isaiah thinking God's controlling everything. No one's listening to him. No one's taking any notice. So God must have somehow planned it that way. That says Isaiah. He's wrong, of course. Jesus, when he's telling the parables, quotes that text, but with such a different meaning. He spoke in parables so that people would stop judging and putting him into different categories, especially the Pharisees, and that they would actually, listen to a story and ask a question. I wonder what he means by that. Once they ask a question, he's got them. Jesus is trying every means to gently enter people's hearts, even those with fixed, theological, locked-in views. So he tells stories, parables. When John's disciples come to Jesus and say, Jesus, are you the one we're waiting for, or was it somebody else? Because he doesn't seem to fit the category too well. He's eating with sinners, for heaven's sake. Someone heard him say to a woman in adultery, I don't condemn you. They heard him in an aeroplane about gay people saying, who am I to judge? And they're thinking, what's going on with this Jesus? John the Baptist wanted the acts there and the baddies and the goodies sorted out. And Jesus is not doing that. He's trying to hold everybody. It's stunning stuff. So Jesus says to John the Baptist's disciples, look, he doesn't claim to be anything. Just go and tell John. The eyes of the blind will be opened. The ears of the deaf unstopped. The lame will leap like a deer. The tongue of the speechless will sing for joy. Waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. That's Isaiah. And he quotes Isaiah saying, go and tell John what you've seen and what you've heard, because you've seen all this. That's all he needs to know. You see what I'm doing? I'm running through page after page of quotes from Jesus about from the various prophets.